Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 370 for Friday, March 16th, 2018. Today we say goodbye to a man who used to work here at the Sun, Bernard V. Lefty Cray. For almost two decades, during the years when the Sun published morning and evening print editions, Lefty Cray was the Morning Sun's outdoors writer. But most of the people who worked here during those years did not realize how famous he was beyond Baltimore. He threw corny jokes my way as I walked past his desk in the old fifth-floor newsroom in the 1980s. But it wasn't until after Lefty left the paper, and I took up fly fishing, that I noticed him prominently featured in books, articles, videos, and mail-order catalogs. Lefty died the other day at 93. He had an amazing life. He fished all over the world, fished with dignitaries and Hollywood celebrities. Millionaires flew him on private jets to their private waters to have Lefty give them private lessons in the art of fly fishing. He wrote 32 books about fly fishing. He invented the most popular saltwater fly, Lefty's Deceiver, that was celebrated as a first-class stamp by the U.S. Postal Service in 1991. Known for his folksy ways as an instructor, he taught hundreds of people how to cast flies.
Let me talk about something else. There's a thing called a double haul. A double haul is where you pull down on a back cast and pull down on a forward cast. Main purpose of double haul is to bend the rod and store energy to let the rod do the job. So you see guys double hauling, and they're tearing their underwear and look like a monkey hoeing cabbage, but they ain't getting nowhere.
Lefty grew up in Frederick County in central Maryland, and he was an artful storyteller. In fact, his fans enjoyed listening to his stories and corny jokes as much as they enjoyed watching him cast a fly line.
The most exciting and demanding fish ever caught, called a New Guinea bass. Biggest, baddest, meanest fish in the world in the river mouth, right inside from the ocean. It has dog, sharp canine dog teeth in it. I ain't never been such prepared for a fish in my life. I got a number 13 line, I got a sailfish rod, I got a 40-pound test leader right straight up to a 50-piece pound to a big deceiver about that long. And I threw the fly in, this big green thing ran out. When I set the hook, I wrapped the line twice around the fly reel. He drug the fish out with a 40-horsepower motor into open water. And worst fighting fish ever. After 2 minutes, it gave up. But it was the damnedest 2 minutes I ever had on a fly rod.
Lefty had been sick since late summer, but I got to visit him a few weeks ago, and he felt well enough for a conversation that lasted about 2 hours. I recorded our talk on my iPhone, and you're going to hear a good bit of that conversation today. I was interested in his relationship with his son, Larry, because among all the people Lefty educated in the ways of fishing and hunting and appreciating the outdoors, I wondered if his number one student was his son. So we're going to start there. By the way, Lefty gave lots of interviews over the years. This might have been his last. It was recorded in early February, a few weeks before his 93rd birthday. Please be patient with the recording. As I say, it's from the voice recorder on my iPhone. And Lefty was breathing with the help of an oxygen tank at the time. On the wall of his living room were many photographs. The one that caught my eye was a photo of Lefty's son, Larry, just a boy at the time, dressed for hunting and wearing red boots.
I have photographs when he was 4 years old, and I took him with me trapping. I was trying to make extra money, pay bills and groceries. And here's little Larry there, standing there, 4 years old, holding two muskrats that I trapped.
Where would you go to do that?
On the VFW golf course, where nobody thought about trapping.
In Frederick County?
Mm-hmm. It was a major golf course there, and none of the trappers thought about trapping on the golf course. So the rats there were plentiful and easy. But beginning about that time, when my son's about five, he's got a .410 shotgun, and he's sitting on a log, and beside him are four squirrels he shot from a canoe while we drifted in the fall on a local river called the Monocacy. He has a pair of bright red boots on that belong to his sister, And he got in all kind of trouble when he came home with mud on her red boots. But we spent constantly together. And
can I interrupt you a moment? He's 5 years old. He's shooting squirrels from a canoe. So you're floating in the Monocacy, and there's like squirrels on the bank?
They're in the trees, in the bank.
And he's using a shotgun?
Yeah. That's one of the best ways to hunt squirrels.
With a shotgun?
Floating on
you
a
float.
Tree. They're not used to seeing anybody. I mean,
from this direction, like out on the water.
Tree, yeah. Yeah, that's an extremely effective way. And we did that for years.
Lefty Cray did a lot of hunting and trapping in his day, but his fame came with fishing, particularly fly fishing. As you'll hear, he got his first fly rod in 1947, his first casting lesson from another legendary American sportsman from Maryland, Joe Brooks. When I visited Lefty last month, he spoke of other forms of fishing with bait and with lures in the Potomac River, near his boyhood stomping grounds.
Spinning was just coming in to the country at that time. It wasn't the best because the nylon we used was really not good nylon. It was made for the Army. It wasn't made for fishing. And it was stiffer than poker, but we learned to use it. And he was using spinny tackle when he was 5 years old. And, of course, that area around Frederick, where I lived, was like all of the eastern United States. It was rural, and you had a small town which was surrounded by farming and another small town that was surrounded by farming. So around each little town that you lived in was a habitat that held lots of fish and plenty of game. The small streams were wadeable. In fact, for somebody 5, 6, 7 like Larry, some of the holes were too deep for wadeable. But we could go out. We first went out and went on a stream, small streams, and we would fish for smallmouth bass and rock bass and all that. Just honed his skills. I was actually teaching him where fish would lie, why they were in a pool, why they were not over the gravel, why would a bend in the stream and the current make a difference. And the truth of the matter is, while I fish some of the biggest rivers in the world, when you go to a big river, it really, if you want to learn to fish it, you fish it the same way you would fish a small river. You just break it down into parts. And so what I was trying to teach him and it was how to, why do the fish stay here? Why don't they stay here? What we have to do to keep care for it and so on. He just loved this stuff.
You know, we could break this show down into chapters with titles. This next one would be called One of Those Days When God Does Not Like Your Son.
I started working for first people to make commercial fly rods, which was Fenwick. So I had a fly rod in a boat for bass, particularly. Mm-hmm. There are days when God does not like your son. And this was one of those days. And unfortunately, Irv Swope, my best friend, knew about this hole, and he would occasionally come up and fish it with a buddy. So he was fishing off to one side, but, you know, he could see us. I had saved up over quite a while enough money to buy what was then totally new, a stainless steel thermos bottle. It was my pride and joy. It cost about 6 times what a normal glass would be. But I could put it in a canoe or take it fishing. A friend of mine worked at the Ever Ready Company right near my home, one of my fishing buddies. And they made pans and pots, and they would dip parts of them in rubber to cover them with rubber, handles and things like that. I had him dip my thermos bottle in that thick rubber. So I had a completely outside rubber base for 2 reasons. One, the Stanley used to have a stainless steel cup. Well, when you put hot coffee in it and put it to your lips,
it's too hot.
But when it was rubber dipped, yeah. But the main reason was I could carry it in the canoe when I was hunting. It never made any noise, didn't rattle around. And I had this thing. I was so proud of this thing, you can't believe. So we were up there one day, and God did not like my son that day. Larry decided he was going to have a cup of coffee. So he opens up this precious thermos bottle. And of course, he was 8 years old. It slipped out of his hand, went to the depths of the coal, and I lost the thermos bottle. Not long after that, he stepped on my brand new Fenwick rod. Now, I could get them for nothing. In fact, they were paying to use it. But I still had to get another one from California, and it ain't like today. Then he fell in the river. It was in early May where it wasn't really cold, but it was cool. But he's soaking wet, so I had to take him over to the bank, build a fire, and dry his clothes out. Ernst and my buddy are just watching this thing like it's a comedy show. Going to tell all my friends when I get back. Well, we got through the day without killing him. and got back to the ramp, and I had a Arkansas Traveler, which was a fairly light John boat. I put that thing on the top. I had a special rack I built so I could put it up there by myself. Put the thing up in there. We got in the car, and we're driving home. And he's small enough at 8. He's just sort of under my arm, leaning up against my shoulder. And as we're driving along, I said, well, son, I said, you know, in a couple more years, you're going to drive this car. You're going to pull the boat. You're going to do all these things. And your dad's going to sit up there and fish like you do. And he was not being smart. He just wanted to know the rules. After this hectic day we had. And he looked up at those innocent eyes and said, Dad, and I said, yes. He said, can I cuss you too? It's a true story.
That's great.
It's a true story.
Lefty Cray's long and celebrated life as one of the world's great fly fishermen started in 1947 when he drove his Model A Ford from Frederick to Baltimore. So Joe Brooks could show him how to use the fiberglass rod he had just purchased from Tochterman's Tackle Shop in the Fells Point section of Baltimore. Joe Brooks took Lefty to a grassy spot along Herring Run on the northeast side of the city, and that's where a larger-than-life man, on his way to legendary status, introduced his new friend and protege, a future legend himself, to the fine art of fly casting. From there, as you'll hear, Lefty learned even more than he already knew about fishing, specifically about trout and the aquatic insects they eat and the wildflowers that grow along the banks of the rivers that he fished with his son and with Brooks and hundreds of others.
When I got my first fly casting lesson in 1947 from Joe Brooks, he became my mentor. And one of the first things he taught me, everything out here is interconnected. For an example, I noticed in Maryland and Pennsylvania that and Virginia, which held trout in the mountain streams, that when trout lilies were blooming,
March brown?
The one before that.
Well, that's stonefly.
No, between them. Oh, it's the one with the pearl body, the peacock body and the gray wings. It's one of the most popular flies in the world.
When the trout lilies were blooming, that meant?
This gray fly, which we can,
yeah,
we'll both think of it in a minute.
Yeah.
Quill Gordon.
Quill Gordons, thank you.
I knew it would come. They came out on about the 15th of April. In a normal year in Maryland, Virginia, or most of Pennsylvania, the gray fly was at 15. About the 1st of May, a brown fly came along, the Hendrickson, and a little bit later, toward the end of the month, sulfurs would come out, who were a dark yellowish. And by June, the light Cahills come out. And so by watching these flowers during the summer, most of the flowers in eastern United States were never here. All of our native flowers bloomed before mid-June because the forest had such a heavy canopy that they would be in deep shade. And so almost any flower you see blooming in this part of the country after the early June was brought in here. It's a non-native species. Then in the summer, the hatches you get, like the trichos and stuff that, they're turning gray. And then in late fall, they're a deep gray. And then in the wintertime, there are black stoneflies. So there is a cycle that begins in January or early February when the skunk cabbage comes out, that you're going to get black stoneflies. And then the progression is from black to dark gray, which a Quill Gordon, then it would go to a dark brown, and then it would go into dark yellow. But my point is, Joe Brooks has said, everything in nature is attached somehow to everything else. He said, look at everything. And I used to do a great deal of hunting. I was an exhibition shooter for Remington Arms at one time. Hunting has the same type thing. But I also was interested in general outdoors and wrote a lot of my columns that way. For example, in the fall, you'll have two red maples on two hills. One will be darker and richer in color than the other one. Well, I had to find out from somebody, why was that? And it has to do with the pH in the soil. That may not seem like anything, but it also indicates that nature is not all the same. There's nothing in nature that's pure white or pure black, not that I know of. But also, as you begin to notice these things, you also begin to notice that a lot of things are backwards of what they claim. For example, some of the finest hatch fishing I've had on mayflies was after the hatch was over and everybody was gone. Because what happens is those flies go downstream and they collect in many eddies. And they are just like a lazy student going around a small hole. And that's when them big browns are just sitting there supping away. So you want to look at the reverse way of things as well. Anyway, I began to teach Larry all this stuff. He was 13. We went to Florida, and I had an assignment from a magazine for Field and Stream to catch a shark on fly, which hardly anybody ever heard of in 1964. And I was poling, because he didn't know how to pole. And I'd get down, and he was holding a rod. I would get down off the, then grab the fly rod, and he would try to keep after the shark. Well, the shark would be going north, and he'd be going west or east or something. So I said, Larry, stop. Today you learn how to pole a boat. And so his education continued. I mean, but we spent hundreds of hours together, and today I have the greatest relationship with my son of anybody I know. He stops here every morning. He was here this morning. Often fixes me a nice breakfast. And I'm now 93 in a couple of weeks, so I ain't much. I couldn't cook anyway. I make coffee and steam in the kitchen. But he also comes every evening and cooks dinner. But he also, anything I ask him to do, he wants to do, which is important. And not only that, but he's never said, I've asked you something, oh, I don't want to do that or something. I never heard that once.
Even when it came to fishing or hunting?
Oh, sometimes he disagreed with fishing or hunting, and he was sometimes right. The implication here is that from when he was 4 years old, we grew together and spent time together. I would hunt butterflies with him, and he would mount them and cigar boxes on cotton. We did so many things together. I got Larry interested in fly fishing when he was about 12. My experience, and I've taught literally hundreds of people to fly fish, is that a child of 10, a boy or girl of 10, is strong enough to fly fish. And they're certainly intelligent enough to do it. The problem is attention span. I remember the first time I did, when I learned a lesson, I did one, a clinic near Pittsburgh for the men and women. And then the next morning, I did one for the kids in this park. Well, they were all listening to me and trying to do it. And suddenly a dog ran across and I lost every one of them. I remember one time at Montauk Point, there was an exception to this. We were up there fishing the stripers when they first started knowing about how to pole the white flats and get them many years ago. Mm-hmm. And there were two boys there, brothers, one about 10 or 9 or 10, the other about 14. The one at 14 was a pretty good caster for his age. The 8, 9, or 10-year-old, I think he was about 10-year-old brother, came to me and said, "Mr. Lefty," I said, "Yeah, I want to be better than my brother, and I want to beat him." He said, "Will you help me learn to cast?" That kid was so focused. He wasn't just listening. He was hearing. And in 3 days, that little kid could outcast his brother. I thought he was going to puff the buttons right off his chest. Anyway, Larry was keen to do this. And we began fly fishing. And I have a photograph of him when he was about 15, where the line's perfectly straight out. And it's probably 65, 70 feet with a tight loop. And when we moved, we'd go to Chesapeake Bay. Or when we moved to Florida, you were in your boat and you were fishing. And Larry would be casting about 40, 45 feet of line. Mm-hmm. He was in his teens, you know, 12, 13, 14. And you know how people can run by in a boat a quarter mile away and you can hear everything they're saying.
Yeah. But
they would look over and they would see this little kid throwing this long line with a tight loop. You'd hear, "Good Lord, look at that kid cast." Immediately, Larry would lengthen the line about 10 more feet. It happened every time.
With all his travels to Florida and well beyond Florida, Lefty always came back to Maryland. As you'll hear, one of his favorite places to fish for smallmouth bass was the Potomac River from boyhood to adulthood and fatherhood up until just a few years ago when he hit the age of 90. Lefty always returned to fish there.
In those days, there were some places on the Shenandoah and the Potomac, but mostly on the Shenandoah, where farmers, they could build their own boats. They were drift boats, a pole boat. You could stay in their house and eat, and they would feed you. So, and I remember it was $5 a day, and I used to take Larry up there. Meals were unbelievable. I mean, they were country ham and the sausage and corn cakes and bacon and eggs. Wow. I mean, just the breakfast alone was just fabulous. That's and dinners nice. Were even better. And they packed a great lunch. And what they do is you would start there at their house, and then you would float a predetermined distance, and then they would pick you up and they would bring the boats back on a trailer. And most of the fish were between 8 and 14 inches. We rarely ever caught a bass there that was big. And I found out many years later that there are numerous subspecies of smallmouth. And, for example, the upper Potomac from about Harper's Ferry up all the way to the Pawpaw, it's rare for a fish there to get more than 12 inches long. One of the reasons is that river is so clear. A really clear river, Danny, for smallmouth is not as good as one that's slightly
turbid,
because the clear water allows the predators to get to the crawfish and all that. And so then you have more bursts of more smallmouths, and so they really don't get that way.
Right.
And genetically, that kind of affects things. For example, I fished many years, 14 years. I used to teach in the Great Smoky Mountains down outside of Asheville. And I'd stay over and fish with them hillbillies down there. I'd stay in their cabin, and they were keeping every brook trout over 10 inches. Mm. And so genetically, they got rid of the brook trout that were going to be longer than 10 inches, naturals in the stream. And they eliminated that subspecies that tended to make bigger fish.
On the
upper Potomac, it was, I think what happened, it ran clear all the time. Even when you had a big rain in a day or two, it was crystal clear. From Hancock and all that area up in there, you could catch 50, 60, 70, 80 fish a day, but rarely get one more than 12 inches. And I think because that environment had been so clear for so many decades, generations, that mother and father bass realized the food supply. So Mother Nature adjusted it.
Yeah.
Once you got the harvest fairing below, you got bigger fish.
When I visited Lefty, he told me of his favorite spot on the Potomac, a large pool he called Twin Rocks. He used to pole a boat up to that spot, and he and his son fished there a lot. It's where Lefty lost his prized rubber-coated stainless steel thermos. It was their special place, but the habitat, as Lefty says, is not what it used to be.
We had started the degradation of the Potomac River. We were losing our fish. The river was being polluted with insecticides and farmers and things. So the last few years, I would go anyway, but it was not like when I could constantly catch fish. I could sit back and have my coffee and my sandwich, and I used to take Fig Newtons as a dessert. And I would just go, and you would fish all day long. So when we find these special places, it's important that we do what we can to cake whatever. If it's a private brook trout stream, we couldn't imagine that the fishing we had in those days would disappear so quickly. I remember that sometimes I would go to the river, millions and millions of fireflies. Now you hardly ever see one. Along a river, any of our rivers, bigger rivers, Monocacy, Potomac, Susquehanna, Juniper, all those rivers had a brown, big brown toad. Every evening, as soon as the sun went down behind the horizon, millions of these toads, rock, 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 like that. And it was a harmony that would go on all night long. Haven't heard that in 30 or 35 years.
If you have a special place in nature you call your own, if you live long enough, you can experience that melancholy I sensed in Lefty about the loss of something that seemed once perfect and pristine, even if it wasn't. Goes a poem by Robert Frost. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold, her early leaf's a flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf, so Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down to day. Nothing gold can stay. But if not physically, some things stay golden in your memory. So every year, up until he was 90, Lefty took a boat up to Twin Rocks on the Potomac.
In the fall, what we call Indian summer in October, where we get those dead calm days with the beautiful sky and the banks of the Potomac are lined with multicolored trees. Most people in those days did not fish much after Labor Day. So you had the river to yourself. And I have fished in 22 countries, from the Amazon and New Guinea to Iceland and Russia and Alaska and all kind of places. But my favorite trip was to go back to my place at Twin Rocks on the summer days in October, when there was going to be no wind, and I would go up and take my lunch and my coffee. I would just sit there, and it would bring back all the memories of how many good times I had with Larry, but also had shared with some other people. And I remember one time when Ev, my wife, said, "You always go up there alone. Why don't you take somebody with you?" And I thought about it. And I said, "Well, when I'm up there by myself, I think about this place that was secret for me for so many years, And in the fall, it's still mine. Nobody's there. And it brings back all the memories. Had I brought someone with me, I wouldn't enjoy to get the enjoyment of all the memories this special place created.
Rest in peace and tight lines forever, Lefty Cray. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are always welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show on iTunes if you get a chance. For the producers, Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes author of historical thrillers Steve Barry, whose latest book, The Bishop's Pawn, introduces the first case for his iconic hero, Cotton Malone. On the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., this is a gripping and provocative thriller about an American icon. Friday, March 23rd at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or 410-377-2966.